Today is Tuesday, January 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. places thousands of troops on high alert as tensions grow with Russia over Ukraine.
The U.S. is making its decisions based on what NATO has called for. And so they are making decisions now, preparing to essentially be ready should NATO respond and ask for more troops.
The World Health Organization warns that COVID-19 will be around for the foreseeable future as infections continue to soar.
It's dangerous to assume that Omicron will be the last variant or that we are in the endgame. On the contrary, globally, the conditions are ideal for more variants to emerge.
And in Burkina Faso, the military junta suspends the constitution, dissolves the government, and closes all borders. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The Pentagon says that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has put up to 8,500 troops on heightened alert. This so they will be prepared to deploy if needed to reassure NATO allies in the face of ongoing Russian aggression on the border of Ukraine. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby says no final decisions have been made on deployment. He said the order is about ensuring that the U.S. is ready to respond if NATO decides to deploy its response force. For more on the implications of this action, I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Barr.
The U.S. is making its decisions with regards to putting in troops and equipment based on what NATO has called for. And so they are making decisions now, preparing to essentially be ready should NATO respond and ask for more troops. The main reason that we're seeing this escalation, this military escalation, is because, according to the U.S. military, Russia is continuing to add battalion tactical groups to the western border, the border with Ukraine. So according to the Pentagon, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby just said that not only has Russia shown no signs of de-escalating, but they are, in fact, adding more force capability. The Pentagon says that these are going to be ready to bolster NATO-allied capabilities in the eastern flank, and that the bulk of these would be for this NATO readiness force, which they call the NRF.
Getting the troops on high alert comes just a few days after the U.S., through the Pentagon, sent lethal weapons to Ukraine. Is there a connection?
So the connection is definitely the actions of the Russian forces on the border. The United States has said that they will help Ukraine, that they've been supporting Ukraine for years. There are currently U.S. forces in Ukraine, some National Guard troops who are training Ukrainian forces. That has been ongoing. And so now there's this added layer, this NATO relief force comprised of about 40,000 multinational troops that will be ready should they need to go to war on their eastern flank, because there are many NATO allies that are incredibly worried. They're looking at what's happening in Ukraine right now, and they're saying, is this going to happen to us next? What is Russia going to do? And how do we respond to what's happening in Ukraine? And the main focus, according to the U.S. military, and not only the U.S. military, the U.S. State Department as well, they say their major focus is to de-escalate and to prevent Russia from going in and invading Ukraine. And so in addition to these troop commitments that we're hearing of just now breaking, there's also been threats of economic sanctions. Anything, any tool that the U.S. and NATO can use to try to get Russia not to invade Ukraine.
Is the Biden administration calculating the reaction of the American public months after the debacle in Iraq, Iran, and also Afghanistan? Is the American public ready for war?
It's very clear, based on President Joe Biden's actions, that he did not want to escalate militarily first. He definitely was trying diplomacy over and over and over again. He sent Secretary Blinken to Ukraine. So I believe the administration wants to use the view of diplomacy first, but they have come to a point where they also do not want to be caught flat-footed should military option be needed. And so that's what these troops are for. They have not been deployed yet. There has been no official declaration of deployments. There's been no decision made to deploy these troops, but they're being on heightened alert so they can be ready to go even faster if needed.
That's VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob speaking with me from Washington. NATO has outlined a series of potential troop and ship deployments as tensions rise between Russia and the West over concerns Moscow is planning to invade Ukraine. Britain says it will withdraw some diplomats from Kyiv, and Ireland warns that upcoming Russia war games off its coast will not be welcome. The State Department has ordered families of all American personnel in Kyiv to leave the country. The move comes amid heightened fears of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, despite talks between U.S. and Russian officials. For more, I spoke with VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent, Cindy Sain.
The State Department had a very unusual Sunday evening briefing, reissuing its travel warning for Ukraine, asking Americans to consider leaving Ukraine. As you said, authorizing the departure of non-essentials and telling family members to leave. So the State Department officials were asked, why is this happening right now? And they said, well, President Biden has said that Russian President Putin might invade Ukraine at any moment. And they said that these were prudential measures, that Russia is still escalating, is still putting more and more forces along the border with Ukraine and in Belarus, and that the U.S. wants to be prepared.
What is the sense you're getting from the State Department? Is this the end of diplomacy, or there's still some room, some wiggle room to talk this through?
I was just listening to the State Department briefing, and I heard spokesperson Ned Price say, no, this is not the end of diplomacy. Basically, we are continuing with diplomacy and dialogue. The U.S. is still going to provide written answers, as Secretary Blinken promised the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov last Friday in Geneva. The U.S. will send written answers to Russia's security concerns. But spokesperson Ned Price is saying basically the U.S. is doing diplomacy and dialogue, and at the same time is readying defense and deterrence measures.
The U.S. talks a lot about unity, not just unity of NATO, but also unity with the European Union. Are they working in concert with this diplomatic channel, or is the U.S. going in on alone?
Again, State Department spokesperson Ned Price was saying that there is no daylight between the U.S. and its European and NATO allies. And some of the reporters at the briefing were challenging that and saying, well, exactly what consequences Moscow would face if it invades Ukraine, that there may be some daylight there. But actually, as we are speaking now, President Biden is holding a secure video call in the Situation Room at the White House with European allies. On the call is French President Macron, German Chancellor Scholz, Polish President Duda, and British Prime Minister Johnson, and NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg. So the U.S. is seeking to, at the highest level, to coordinate again and again with NATO and European allies on this.
That's VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain speaking with me from Washington. Since 2017, evidence of Iran's new precision strike weapons capability has been growing across the Middle East. In the last 5 years, the Revolutionary Guard has used highly accurate missiles and drones to hit a range of targets in the region. Yemen's Iran-allied Houthi movement used Iranian cruise missiles and ballistic missiles alongside drones in the recent deadly strike on the United Arab Emirates. Reporter Angie Omar discussed with David DeRoches, associate professor of the Near East South Asian Center for Strategic Studies, to what extent could Iran's actions destabilize the Gulf's security.
Iran's actions, or the actions of Iran's proxies, were designed to do two things. First, to bring the war in Yemen to the front of the Emirati consciousness, to let them know that what UAE forces enable or facilitate in Yemen will be responded for directly in the Emirates. And secondly, it's designed to harm the UAE's image as a global city, as a center of global commerce, things like hosting the expo in Dubai, stuff like that. They want to send a message saying, you are not safe. And if we wish to disrupt this magnificent, set of cities that you've built, we will do it. So this is designed to strike, send a message right at the heart of the modernization effort at Abu Dhabi and the rest of the UAE, which is, one of the most modern cities and countries in the world. It's a very, very profound statement, a very, very profound act of violence.
U.S. President Joe Biden said on Wednesday his administration is considering redesignating Yemen's Houthi movement as an international terrorist organization. However, the administration is trying to revive the agreement with Iran to curb its nuclear ambitions. Could an agreement with Iran in Vienna insist that Iran stop its malign activities in the region, especially providing its proxies with sophisticated weapons?
It's possible, but extremely unlikely. Iran's position has been publicly, and what we hear from various leaks privately, that these talks are going to focus just on reviving the nuclear agreement. The big criticism of the nuclear agreement at the time was that the United States gave Iran basically license to develop its ballistic missile program to, continue to reinforce its networks of proxies in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and other countries such as Bahrain. So that's a pretty valid criticism. And Biden, in his public statements, has said, well, we want to expand the Iran agreement. But the Iranians, meanwhile, say, well, wait a minute, we didn't leave this. If you made a bad deal, that's on you. So I don't think the Iranians have any incentive to go beyond the nuclear issue in the Vienna talks. And I don't see how, I'm sure that the Biden administration would welcome an agreement on that, but I don't think that he has the ability to coerce the Iranians into doing that. So sadly, I think we're going to have to continue to deal with Iranian weapons and missiles, regardless of who fires them.
That's reporter Angie Omar speaking with David DeRoches, associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. The head of the World Health Organization is warning that COVID-19 will be around for the foreseeable future, and everyone would have to learn to live with it. The WHO chief issued the warning yesterday at the opening of the agency's week-long executive board meeting. Lisa Schneider reports for VOA from Geneva.
2 years ago, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a public health emergency of international concern. Then there were fewer than 100 cases and no deaths reported outside China. Those numbers now stand at nearly 350 million cases and more than 5.5 million deaths. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says it is hard to know when the pandemic will end. However, while the coronavirus is circulating, he says it will continue to mutate in unpredictable and dangerous ways.
It's dangerous to assume that Omicron will be the last variant or that we are in the end game. On the contrary, globally, the conditions are ideal for more variants to emerge.
Tedros says countries must learn to manage this deadly disease and use the knowledge gained to prepare for future pandemics. To change the course of the pandemic, he says the conditions driving it must change. He says the acute phase of the pandemic can be ended this year if countries use all the strategies and tools available to combat COVID-19. He adds this will work only if all countries, rich and poor alike, have equitable access to vaccines, treatments, and other tools.
Vaccines alone are not the golden ticket out of this pandemic. But there is no path out unless we achieve our shared target of vaccinating 70% of the population of every country by the middle of this year. We have a long way to go.
The WHO chief notes 86 countries have not been able to reach last year's target of vaccinating 40% of their populations. He warned the emergency phase of the pandemic will not end until the gap between the haves and have-not countries is bridged. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa has seen a jump in pet sales during the coronavirus pandemic, and not just for guard dogs, which are common because of a high crime rate. South Africa's pet shops say in a world of social distancing, people are finding companionship in a range of furry and even slithering animals. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
For many, finding a snake in their garden would be a fright, but for 15-year-old Jimmy Deeb, it's a comforting sight. He started adopting snakes during the first pandemic lockdown, in part being inspired by a friend who had a snake as a pet.
I just used to spend my days playing with my snakes and just holding them and cleaning the enclosures and looking at them. They really are just majestic animals. It's not an aggressive evil killer like people think. And I can tell you that they are really awesome pets. I have dogs and I have some snakes that are like dogs. Like, they are really intelligent.
And he says he's not alone in his hobby. He's joined online groups with other snake parents to share tips and tricks about where to buy and how to take care of the creatures. They're certainly not for everyone, but pet ownership and spending on pet care, from health to treats, has climbed during the pandemic, according to market research firm Euromonitor International. Cat breeder Cheryl Moss says there was certainly a rise in sales for more traditional pets.
I think a lot of people now, they've realized home is actually where your heart needs to be, not work. And they need to now make their homes a home where they've got someone to come home to and share with them. And I've certainly had a lot of queries, a lot of interest. People saying, you know what, I'm lonely, it's time for a companion.
The pandemic was particularly hard for Dr. Cherie Claire Sismuck and her husband, who is also a physician. She says getting a ragdoll kitten helped relieve their stress.
Sometimes the unspoken love of a cat, especially after a rough shift where you don't even really want to talk and you just have someone who just is there, loves you, cuddles you. When you get home and you hold that baby, you just feel... Okay, I can breathe.
Psychologists agree that pets have therapeutic benefits, and that emotional support is increasingly recognized by the public. Lee Tucker is a clinical psychologist at the University of the Western Cape.
So we are seeing that there has been very positive shifts that have been made, where there's a lot more narrative around the role of dogs and cats in the household and what they can offer. And our animal companions can be there to provide that comfort and that reassurance during difficult times.
While the pandemic has changed perceptions of the role of cats and dogs in the home, Tucker warns economic pressures and job losses are forcing some families to give up their new pets. That's not a concern for Deeb, who anticipates his collection growing.
And I would like to do that one day, open like my own little reptile zoo. And I also was looking into going into nature conservation and that. So I love nature and animals.
Snakes may not be conventional pets, but they can certainly give you a hug. And in the eyes of their owners, they're great companions. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Beijing has been exporting traditional Chinese medicine around the world, including to countries in Africa, with claims of helping with COVID. These herbal clinics are welcomed by some, while others are raising concerns about the effectiveness of such medicines and lack of regulation in the field. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
My life now is not that productive.
85-year-old Heng Pal Singh is among dozens of patients with daily appointments at the Oriental Chinese Herbal Clinic in Nairobi. Singh has been suffering from spinal problems for 5 years and is now trying out this clinic for treatment.
There is a slight difference. As I was telling him that it's only a week now, he says it'll take at least maybe another at least 12 to 15 sessions, and then we see how it goes.
Traditional Chinese medicine, or TMC, is becoming more popular in Africa, according to a 2020 study by Development Reimagined, a Beijing-based international consultancy firm. A February 2020 op-ed written by a Beijing think tank researcher and published in State Media China Daily said such traditional medicine will boost the Chinese economy, contribute to global health, and prove to be a shot in the arm for China's soft power. But conventional medical doctors say patients are overlooking the potential harm that some herbal remedies can cause, especially if used too frequently or too high a dosage.
They do work in quite a number of circumstances. Now, having said that, our main worry as the medical practitioners is that the use of herbal medicine is not as regulated as we would want it to be.
This is Chinese ginseng.
Although the safety and effectiveness of the traditional Chinese medicine is still debated worldwide, herbal practitioners like Li Shuang continue to gain popularity among those seeking alternative medication. Li claims some of his patients are benefiting from purported COVID-19 remedies, although there's a scant scientific evidence that they can help against the disease.
Many people buy herbal tea to prevent COVID-19. The result are good.
Environmentalists fear the growth of traditional Chinese medicine will encourage poachers to go after endangered wildlife like rhinos and some species of snakes used in making the potions.
The rhino in Kenya is actually one of the good examples. With people saying that The line of horn may actually help in improving to be used as an aphrodisiac. This has led to almost complete annihilation of the rhino species in Kenya and in Africa in general.
Kenya spends an estimated $2.7 billion each year on healthcare, according to national statistics. Some economists say herbal medicine can significantly lower the cost of medical expenses in the continent if proven effective.
Africans spend quite a bit of money traveling to countries like such as India, the UAE, to get treatment. So if this can provide more natural, more cost-effective healthcare, because cost effectiveness is a big reason of why people choose different types of healthcare.
In 2021, Kenya's national drug regulator, the Pharmacy and Poisons Board, approved the sale of Chinese herbal health products in the country. Practitioners like Lee hope that more nations will approve Chinese herbal medicine in the future. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
In other news, more than a dozen mutinous soldiers declared Monday on state television that the military junta now controls Burkina Faso. This after they detained the democratically elected president following a day of gun battles in the capital. The military coup is the third of its kind in West Africa in the last 18 months, creating perilous upheaval in some of the countries hardest hit by Islamic extremist attacks. Captain Sitso Kabakodrago says the patriotic movement for safeguarding and restoration will work to establish a calendar acceptable to everyone for holding new elections. He did not give details. The European Union says the situation in Burkina Faso is, quote, worrying, unquote, and is calling for the release of the country's president, Roch Kabore. The comments came after Burkina Faso's army announced it had ousted Kabore, suspended the constitution, dissolved the government and National Assembly, and closed the country's borders. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Opo in Washington. With its borders closed and virtually all foreigners gone, North Korea is more inaccessible than ever during the coronavirus pandemic. So to learn about a reclusive country's economy, some North Korean watchers are picking up whatever scraps they can. In some cases, that means literally examining North Korean trash, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from the inter-Korean border.
It's a cold January afternoon, and Professor Kang Dong-won is scouring the beach for trash. Specifically, North Korean trash that has washed ashore here on Yeonpyeong Island. It's a remote South Korean island near the disputed sea border with North Korea. Kang is excited. This is the 35th different type of Eskimo brand ice cream that he's found. In total, he's collected over 1,400 pieces of North Korean trash over the past year.
The waste is so diverse. Food, beverages, snacks, medicines, cosmetics. It's like a little market here at the beach.
Kang has visited North Korea. He used to make research trips to Chinese cities near the North Korean border. But during the pandemic, this is as close as he can get. And North Korea is incredibly close, just 4 kilometers away, easily visible with the naked eye, even in poor weather.
Turns out it's not actually that hard to find North Korean trash on South Korean beaches just like this one, if you know what you're looking for.
This propaganda leaflet slams conservative South Korean politicians. This piece of rubber was part of a trash bin at a thermal power plant. And like many products, this instant noodle wrapper specifies the exact factory where it was made. Important clues about what North Korea can import and produce, and how it markets products in perhaps the least capitalist country in the world.
During the Kim Jong-un era, North Korea has put more effort into package design. Not even North Korea can ignore the tastes and desires of its people.
In the quiet village nearby, residents say they barely notice the North Korean trash. Oh Ki-im says she's seen more than just garbage wash ashore.
Landmines also float around. You have no idea how much stuff comes from the north. So many products, even human corpses.
Kong, though, remains fascinated by just the trash. He's even written a book on his findings.
With this trash, I can see the lives of North Koreans. It helps me understand North Korea.
With North Korea closed indefinitely, scraps may be all that he has for a while. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea.
The UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency, is appealing for nearly $60 million for tens of thousands of victims of intercommunal clashes over dwindling resources in Cameroon's far north region. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The appeal is aimed at helping UNHCR and its partners provide needed humanitarian aid for those displaced by the crisis during the next 6 months. An ongoing dispute over diminishing water resources between herders on one side and fishermen and farmers on the other last month erupted into a violent confrontation. The UN Refugee Agency says 44 people were killed, more than 100 injured, and 112 villages burned to the ground. In the space of 2 weeks, UNHCR spokesman Boris Chishikov says 100,000 people fled to neighboring Chad or elsewhere in Cameroon.
This has become a severe crisis because of the climate emergency and the surface waters of Lake Chad shrinking, and the Longong River, which runs along the border between Cameroon and Chad. It demarks the border, and this is where the tensions began.
This crisis follows a previous deadly encounter in August. Some 45 people reportedly were killed, dozens injured, and more than 30 villages set ablaze. An estimated 23,000 fled to Chad or elsewhere in Cameroon. Cheshirkov says the appeal will provide critically needed relief over the next 6 months for both the displaced and those sheltering them in Chad and Cameroon. Priority needs, he says, include shelter, blankets, mats, and mosquito mats.
The funds will also cover growing water, sanitation, and hygiene needs, child protection, prevention and response to gender-based violence, documentation, education, all of these are urgent priorities. We estimate that 9 out of 10 of the Cameroonian refugees that are now in Chad as a result of this crisis are women and children.
Cheshikov says the situation has calmed down in the last few weeks. He says security has been reinforced. He notes government-led reconciliation efforts supported by the UNHCR are underway. He adds urgent action is needed to address the root causes of the conflict. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new British-based study provides evidence that the melting of a giant iceberg called A68A has released some 152 billion metric tons of fresh water into the South Atlantic Ocean near the island of South Georgia. According to a press release from the UK's University of Leeds, 152 billion metric tons could fill 61 million Olympic-sized swimming pools. The huge chunk of ice, then called A68, fell into the ocean after breaking away or calving from the Larsen Sea ice shelf that runs along the eastern coast of the Antarctic Peninsula in July 2017. With an area of nearly 6,000 square kilometers, iceberg A68 was once considered to be the world's sixth largest iceberg. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington, wishing you a great day.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba 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 zip.